And my real goal with Totally EV was to have an independent voice in the car industry. Because if you look at a lot of car reviews, other than influencers, their main goal as a car publication is not to actually give you a review, it's actually to sell you a car.
Ladies, gentlemen, everybody, welcome back to Media Voices. We are the media-focused B2B news organization that takes a look at everything to do with the media. That's from a journalistic point of view, a commercial point of view, basically every single thing that we can find to fill our daily newsletter. Speaking of which, you can sign up to that by going to voices.media and signing up. That contains the four most important news stories of the day, and it goes out every single day of the working week. Basically, for us, the media world never stops spinning.
You're getting good at this.
Thank you. Well, I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
And I'm Esther Thorpe. And we have Paulie Peter this week. So
yeah,
he'll listen and he'll just bottle everything up and just be like, no. And that clip you heard was from my interview with Christopher Menasians, who is director and editor at Totally EV, which is a site dedicated to articles, reviews and interviews about electric vehicles. It's also actually recently hit 5 million views on YouTube. So we talked about building an audience through video reviews, the differences he sees between his electric vehicle coverage and his more consumer-focused tech reviews on his other channel, Totally Dubbed HD, and what it takes to run your own review site, including getting access to vehicles as a solo publisher. So I think given some of the stuff we've talked about in the past couple weeks with Google and sort of how small publishers are trying to play in that space, it's a really interesting interview, and I hope you all like it.
Nice.
But first, you've got to put up with our nonsense.
We're going to be talking about audio and podcasts and some recent trends and news items in and around that space. But we're going to begin with a peek behind the curtain. Esther, where do you typically listen to podcasts now? Obviously, we've been doing a lot of long listing for the Publisher Podcast Awards, so it's been a lot of, in my experience, proprietary players on sites. But where do you listen to podcasts in general?
Spotify. I put them onto Spotify. And I'm a Spotify premium subscriber and have been for like over a decade now, so goodness knows how much of my money they've taken. I don't even want to do all the calculations.
Things are afoot in the world of podcasting, and it's one of those where we can talk about Google. We can talk about Google sunsetting some of its most promising apps and the most well-used apps. Go on, you're going to say something.
1.55% of our listeners are Google Podcasts.
I suppose that goes into explain our first news item here, which is that last September, Google announced that it was sunsetting Google Podcasts, and it's going to concentrate on YouTube Music, which hosts podcast content as well. This week, that really it happened. That transition
in the
has
US,
begun.
Didn't it?
Yeah,
they've not actually done it anywhere else yet.
The transition has begun, and so we're now looking at a Google Podcast-less world. And you mentioned Spotify before, so I think on the face of it, this move makes sense. Relatively low proportion of listenership happens on Google Podcast, at least for us. And Spotify, for instance, has both podcast and music appearing within the same app. And, you know, And other than the fact that podcasts tend to be longer than even prog rock songs, there's no functional difference between music and podcast MP3s. They can coexist on platforms. And if you are Spotify, you've got it down to a fine art. They do not recommend music after a podcast and vice versa. So they're effectively two separate streams, but within the same app. But what it does mean is that once again, publishers and creators who did distribute through Google Podcasts are having to change strategy once again. And an already fragmented landscape is evolving once again. I think that the writing potentially was on the wall when we saw that YouTube was the sleeping giant of the podcast world. We've sort of known that for a couple of years.
Yeah, and I suppose on the face of it, if you're Google and you're looking at that as a sort of, well, if you're Alphabet and you're looking as a top level thing, and you're saying, well, all this, and YouTube has really come up as an unexpected source of podcasts. And I don't think even they really expected it to become quite the giant it has. Obviously, it was rated as the top source last year or something. Yeah. There was some really bonkers stat like that. And if you're looking, you've kind of got that product, I guess, why focus your energy elsewhere?
Yeah, very much. So it does kind of make sense from Google's perspective. And I think that, you know, to your point there, it's because YouTube accidentally was in the right place at the right time to host video podcasts.
I think you put that piece in Fuck It on the Verge, that savage piece in the Verge that was just basically saying, it's just another product in the Google graveyard, and that it says this is called the Google cycle. It always goes the same way. They launch a new service with grandiose language about how this fits its mission of organizing and making accessible the world's information. It updates with a couple of neat features, immediately forgets it exists, launches a competitor, begins to depreciate it and shifts focus to the new competitor. And then years later, it finally shuts it down for real.
Yeah.
This guy just says, you know, the Google graveyard is full of apps like Reader, Duo, Inbox, Allo, Wallet, and countless others that have just been through the Google cycle.
Like, imagine if they said, right, we're doing a Google pacemaker now. And you go, not sure.
Yeah, and I think the piece made a really good point that it's, given the size of Google and the resources it had, Google had a really good opportunity to do something good with this app. What they're doing with YouTube is very much shoehorning the podcast experience because that's how people watch the videos. Whereas, yeah, this guy says Google could have found a way to actually connect up those services. So, you know, if you're watching a short or something in YouTube, it should have said, you know, here's a way you can subscribe to this podcast in Google Podcasts, and just made it a lot cleaner. A couple of years ago, I can remember they started putting Google Podcasts in the top of search. If you searched for something that was a relevant podcast, they'd bring the podcast up, and that was sort of starting to get really exciting.
This next story is fascinating because I think it speaks to this. People know that podcasting is big business. So Apple is making some relatively big moves in the podcast space.
Apple have been sort of quite good in launching some paid podcast tools in the last couple of 18 months or so.
Mm-hmm.
But they've then made it, they've got this carousel at the top of Apple Podcasts, which has got these sort of recommended and promoted shows. And I think Max said that the majority of them were then these subscription shows. So there was then some questions about like, oh, do you now have to be a paid show in order to get your show featured in that top bar?
No,
it's a little bit.
Come on, you don't have to be. Does it help? Yeah.
A lot of people's hesitation about launching paid podcasts is that the threshold to subscribe to it is very, very high. You're not just going to subscribe to a paid podcast on a whim. You're going to want to listen to it first, get to know the host, build that relationship.
Yeah.
They're very much like an end of funnel subscription product. And it's like you're saying about discoverability. People aren't going to discover paid podcast shows if they're never promoted, but maybe the balance of promotion has just gone a bit over the top there. But I would love to know what those conversion statistics were. You know, how many people actually went, saw those promoted shows, paid, and then listened to them?
Yeah, absolutely.
Can I do a really shameless plug here?
Yes.
So if this conversation interests you, please come to the Publisher Podcast Summit on the 12th of June this year in London. We actually have immediate media coming to speak about paid podcasts and subscription podcasts. They've used a slightly different strategy where they've got quite a lot of listeners to shows already, and they've launched paid podcasts as a sort of subscriber benefit for the super fans. And they'll actually be taking us through that. So if you'd like to come and join us and see Chris's face live,
there are bigger reasons to come.
we've got pre-agenda. That is your first sneak of the agenda. We've got pre-agenda rates on at the moment at publisherpodcasts.com. So, yeah, please do come along if you want to know more about launching a subscription podcast on Apple.
What's this next post you put in here, though, about the Substack one? I didn't read this one.
Oh, so this was a really interesting post that came out from Substack itself about the power of kind of it's audio and video, but the case studies are mainly audio, to grow subscriptions on Substack. And they said that, in this post, we've seen from our data that writers who've been augmenting their publications with audio or video in some way, whether that be a show that anchors their Substack or supplementary material such as narrations, grow their mailing lists and revenue 2.5 times faster than publishers who don't use audio and video, which I thought was a really interesting stat. And I think it just helps you keep front of mind for people. And I don't know if there's something in if you're subscribed to a writer on Substack and you can hear them and see them, if you feel slightly more connected, I guess that you were sort of alluding to that, weren't you? It's just
I completely believe that. Just kind of going like, oh well, I know them, I appreciate them as a person, and therefore I know that what they're going to write is great. So yeah, I can see that. It's an interesting 2.5 times though. That's huge. But I suppose there's also like to go back to Google sunsetting everything. If you're putting the effort in to do additional things in, you know, on top of just writing, then you can probably guarantee that there'll be good quality stuff and they'll stick around for longer as well.
Talking of consuming things from brands in ways you'd want, that was disgusting. I'm gonna roll with it.
Get the word content in there as well. Get the word content in.
So the New York Times have announced this week that they are planning to make the vast majority of their articles available to users as narrations. Not read via reporters, which I thought was really interesting, but actually via an automated voice. They're not the first publisher to do this. They're not the last. But I was actually a little bit, I did write about this in the newsletter, I was actually a little bit disappointed in this.
In them as a brand for doing this.
Well, the New York Times are one of the leading news brands in the world. They're also one of the leading news brands in audio. They published something like 2,500 audio recordings last year. The Daily is like a flagship podcast in terms of how to do news podcasts from a publisher, right? And it was just a little bit like, if you've got all these resources and these great teams sitting here, why are you just plugging automation into it? I don't know. It just felt a little underwhelming.
I know. And we've railed against this before, and I'm being entirely cynical here, and I'm being quite Blade Runner about this. Why would you not say get your journalists to do, I don't know, 10 or 12 themselves, train an AI up on their voice, and then get the automated voice to do it as that reporter?
So that's what Sheepstead did. They've gone and launched that across all of their publications, and they trained it on one of their popular podcast journalists, which I read at the time. That's a bit like, that's creepy, but also kind of brilliant. And yeah, they trained the AI on the podcast she'd done, and it was able to then just read articles in her voice, which is a bit more like with slightly last days, but that's more I'd have expected from the NYT if you've got that kind of resources to actually do something a bit clever with it, not just be like, nah, we're just plugging an automated voice in, which if you do, no problem. That's great. Like, loads of publishers do that and see great results with it. And it's a sort of nice, cheap way of offering things to people in a different way. But yeah, just the NYT could have done something more interesting here.
Well, this last stat that you've put in, I think, is really interesting here. So that 15-20% one. As you said here, the Times eventually plans to have all its articles narrated in some way, which is good. You know, that's more accessible, I suppose. And the majority of that is going to be automated, which has those issues we were talking about. But 15 and 20% of articles, especially the more personal stories, are likely to be read as reporter reads. So they are going to get their personality in to do it. I just wonder if, as with Shipstead, we need to see provenance for this. I say provenance all the f***ing time now because I used it in an article on our site about AI-generated art. And on that I said, people now are watching artists live stream the creation of art because then at least they can be guaranteed that it was not AI-generated.
I can remember talking to Chris Stone at the New Statesman last year when they launched their audio long reads, which is where they got sometimes their journalists and sometimes voice actors to read out their feature pieces. And he said that, although he'd love journalists to do it all the time, he said, actually, there's something about having a voice actor who really knows their craft reading a piece. And he said, you just get so much more from it. And I think it's just that sort of professional voice that certainly AI is a little way off replicating it. I mean, our charm is in our lack of professionalization, right?
Oh, yeah. So that's one thing that AI can never recreate. In fact, that's it. People can guarantee that we will be the last non-automated podcast because there will still be errors. We will still be talking over one another. We'll still be gabbling and like slurring our words. But we should probably finish this off with some good news about podcasting, you know, considering that we're doing the Publisher Podcast Awards and the Summit and everything. And there are some really, really positive stats in this from Edison Research. So, I mean, why don't you start with some of those top line stats about who's listening and when and to what extent?
Yeah. So unsurprisingly, maybe it is surprisingly given there's been so many headlines about like layoffs, ad shortfalls, restructuring, but actual underlying podcast listening habits are continuing to grow according to Edison Research. So they did a survey and showed that 67% of people have listened to a podcast ever, which is up from
60% last year. Yeah. I can see that. Yeah, that checks out.
47% of those have listened in the last month, 34% in the last week. And the stats for young Americans are really, really high. 59% of those under 35. Glad I'm still considered young.
God, I'm not in that anymore. I'm not in that.
And 55% of those under 54, they are, you're in that one, have listened to podcasts at least once a month.
The fact that there is that kind of parity almost between 59% of people under 35 and 55%, that's not that much difference. It's not like margin of error, but it's still really, really good.
So what's going on with the top-level industry? Is this just like right-sizing?
Well, I was thinking about this. So the second you put this in the notes, I was like, well, I can think of at least two hype cycles that have happened in my time within the industry. And one was, in fact, it was even before I began in the industry. It was like 2006 even, when The Guardian started doing podcasts in earnest. You know, they did the Ricky Gervais podcast. They got a lot of listeners to that. And that really sparked this boom of people doing initial exploration of that. And then there was a bit of a dieback. Definitely spoken about on this podcast before. The fact that a lot of publishers got rid of their podcasting teams and lost years and years and years of expertise. And then all of a sudden you see investment from places like Google, Spotify, and they start building their teams back up, but they've lost that initial bout of people who knew what was going on. At a point now where the industry is mature, there are really, really good monetization tools and platforms. And yet we're constantly thinking about ourselves as being kind of the new kids on the block when we're not really. I mean, what do you think? Are we right-sizing after the latest hype wave, or is it now people are finally getting to grips with the potential of podcasts?
I don't know. I feel like the pandemic kind of kicked all that as well. And it's difficult to tell what is crashing down, like the ad situation, what is crashing down because of the pandemic and its sort of post effects, and what would have naturally risen and fallen anyway. But I think what is undeniable is the popularity of podcasts among younger people. I think when you look at it, it's publishers like History Extra have been doing it for years and years and kept it really consistent that have been rewarded in the long term.
You know what else is undeniable? We're the best goddamn media podcast on the block.
Maybe that should be our sign off.
We'll try it this time. We'll try it this time. And if people like it, we'll carry on.
So there was a little sneak of the podcast summit agenda in the middle of that. We have a newsletter summit running at the same time, but I'm going to save a sneak peek for that for next week. This is June the 12th in London. We've got workshops on monetizing niche and smaller podcasts. We've got a practical hands-on session about video strategy for podcasts, including the use of AI in video production.
Oh my God.
And as I've mentioned already and halfway through that, we've got Immediate coming and talking about testing and learning from creating premium content and subscription bundles in podcasting. That's a little sneak peek. The agenda will be coming very, very soon. But you can actually book your tickets to that now at publisherpodcasts.com at a pre-agenda rate. So get on it. So this week I spoke to Chris Menasians, who is director and editor at Totally EV, a reviews and guide site for electric vehicles. So we discussed building trust with an audience and his own approach to hands-on reviews. We actually had a spell working together at Dennis Publishing a few years ago, which he does reference a couple of times. So I started by asking him what brought him to the point of founding the site.
I graduated business and French at university many years ago. From there, I worked in PR for roughly 2 to 3 years because I was in communication with PRs as a YouTuber. So I was like, I really enjoy being in this industry. Why don't I just work in PR? And I didn't have really the qualifications to be a journalist.
The dark side.
The dark side, exactly. So I started in PR. But after working in PR for numerous years, I realized I want to get a bit more technical, because the actual bits that I enjoy the most of PR are the technical elements of it. Just by complete, not say chance, but I applied to a B2B tech role in journalism at IDG. I went to the interview. It all went really well, but I got declined because someone else had a better CV. But then they opened up a position, which was basically maternity cover for me, because they really appreciated my consumer knowledge that I had. I then moved over to Dennis. They really liked what I did and my recommendation. So then I worked at Dennis, as you know, and that's where we met for, I think it was three years. And then I got approached by this company, which was a startup working in electric vehicles. They work in the tech industry, but they wanted to work and branch out in the car industry. And long story short, I worked there for 6 months, helped design the website. I designed the logo with the help of one of my cousins. I wrote so many articles, news features, and reviews, did all the video editing, the picture editing, you name it, even managed freelancers. And the pay was really bad, but in my contract, it was said that I would have a percentage stake in the company after 1 year, 2 years, then 3 years. And 6 months in, I woke up one day, I didn't have access to the CMS. Overnight, I basically didn't have a job. I had a contract which says I'm editor in chief. And they basically turned around and said, oh yeah, no, we never had that in mind. We just want you to be a freelancer now. I'm like, that's not going to happen. Anyway, after those experiences, and even after being left unemployed with zero income, and at the time I was paying double rent, so it was quite a lot, I said to myself, look, I've created a website and done everything from the ground up for an electric vehicle website and publication, and I do YouTube videos. Why don't I just take this a bit more seriously? Why don't I just be like, okay, I can do it myself? And after talking to my mother about it, which, you know, she's one of my greatest inspirations in my life, she told me, look, I've got your back. you know, you go ahead, do your thing. I've got your back. And if you need anything, I'm here. So just with that reassurance, I went ahead and completely revamped my YouTube channel. I went from taking it as a hobby to taking it as a business model. So charging companies and being a bit more tactical as to what I was reviewing and how I was reviewing it. Completely changing the entire review process from top to bottom, from being just a camera in front of a monitor to earphones or headphones to adding B-roll and getting camera equipment, lighting equipment. So really like ramping it up. If I look at my old stuff, even from just 2 years ago, I kind of laugh to myself as to where it's come now. So because of taking it as a business model, it meant that I was now looking at charging companies, and that's added a revenue stream for me. It was minimal at first, but it was still something that I could actually focus on. And as for Totally EV, because I'd done everything before, I literally did everything from the ground up. I learned HTML coding, and even though I use WordPress and WordPress plugins and stuff like that, I learned HTML, basic HTML coding. I did logo design. I did all the written pieces. I learned Photoshop a bit more to, like, again, increase my skills and knowledge of that. I learned an entire new video editor. And because of all of those things combined, it meant that I created Totally EV, which had a lot of news and feature pieces at the time. And my real goal with Totally EV was to have an independent voice in the car industry. Because if you look at a lot of car reviews, other than influencers, you will notice that a lot of them are not sponsored, but they have a lot of ties with manufacturers, which is fine. That's absolutely fine. But some of the big guys out there, their main goal as a car publication is not to actually give you a review. It's actually to sell you a car. So I said to myself, when I'm looking at these reviews, why is it then they're not comparing and contrasting between different cars? Why are they not talking, for example, about electric vehicle range and performance and saying this is good, this is bad? They're just listing the facts. And of course, they're testing it, but they're not really diving into it and giving their honest opinion. At least that's not what I felt. So I said to myself, okay, I'm going to try and create that and have a reviewer's voice for electrified vehicles. And after I got my first, second, and third car in, and it took about 6 to 7 months for me to get my first car in, and it's because of previous relationships that they knew who I was, and because I had built up the website, it was a snowball effect. I had cars every single week, week in, week out, for almost about a year and a half. I was working pretty much 7 days a week, flat out, but it was still a massive honor to me because I was reviewing a lot of cars. And at the same time, I was doing tech and building those relationships business-wise, editorially-wise, and, you know, branching out. So it was actually a lot of hard things that came about that ended up being the best thing in my professional career.
So do you find with the EV side of things, is it people just come for a specific vehicle review, or are they interested in sort of watching the whole series of reviews? Like, how do you find the audience sort of behaves on that site?
I would say on the site, more specifically, they're coming for that particular product. So they're coming for, let's say, I don't know, Tesla Model 3. They're coming for that specific product, and they're coming to either comment on the review because they've got experience themselves, or because they're looking for some advice. More often than not, I can see that the viewership on the website is more passive. So they're not engaging as much on the comment section, even though the comment section's open and you don't need an account or anything like that to log in. They're just looking at it. So I can see the page impressions and the unique visitors are there, and they're looking at it. And sometimes I see that the website is being linked in forums. So they're like, oh, look at this review from this person, or look at, you know, Totally EV's review of X, Y, and Z. On YouTube, it's a lot more active, so the comments are a lot more engaging. There's a lot more engagement on YouTube, which I really love. Bit for better or worse, you've got some people who are always going to flame you or whatever, or always know better, which, you know, they might know better. I have no idea, but yeah, it's a lot more engagement. And there, it's a combination of things. There's some people who are just returning subscribers that are just interested in electrified vehicles generally. There's some people who are interested in certain categories of vehicles. So, for example, I don't know, hybrids or SUVs or fully electric vehicles, whatever it might be. And there's other people who are completely new to the channel and just comment being like, "I came across your review because I was looking for some information on this product, and I attained it," which ultimately, that's my goal. I want to create written or video reviews, that when you come to it, you get everything you need to know about that. And then you go away being like, I have all the information I need. I can make my own informed decision now, because I am ultimately the person who's going to be buying the product or not buying the product. And then I can go ahead and just make my decision. And it's been really helpful in that respect, because I've seen some comments come in of people who are like speccing 100K cars. And they're like asking, for example, about an audio system, because I've been kind of renowned for doing audio system reviews on Total EV. And they're asking me about audio upgrades. Should they or should they not go for this option or not? When they're speccing up, let's say, a Porsche Taycan, which starts from like £88,000. Most people are like spending over 130K. So it's really like reassuring. And it just makes me feel honored that these people are coming to me for my expert advice and saying what is best, or even just simply, what's the best settings I should have for the audio or for my car?
It's interesting that you pointed this out beforehand, that there's that contrast between, there's an awful lot of publishers who've got the expertise to be doing that sort of thing, but just aren't meeting that market need. I suppose that's something that's changed over the last sort of 20 years, as models have come under pressure, that publishers are just sort of shifting away from, we just want to do a car review, to all this sort of more sort of self-interested stuff.
It's time and money. That's the biggest thing. It was the same when I was working at Dennis Publishing. So I remember my initial reviews that I was writing there were super detailed. They'd cover, like, so I was doing a smartphone, for example, I remember. And I covered, not say every single detail there is to know about the smartphone, but a lot of detail. I mean, I think it came to like 4,500 words, which is...
That's a lot.
A long review. Right. But I'm just really passionate about it. I would write or do such videos. But my editors rightfully said, like, our audience are not interested in that much amount of detail. They just want to know, is it good or bad in these certain areas? So it went from writing 4,500 word reviews, which took me a lot longer, to writing 1,500 word reviews, which still covered everything that I was covering in a 4,500 review, but just not as much detail. And the same sort of principle applies on YouTube now because of people's attention span, and also on the written reviews that I currently do on Totally EV. If you scroll back and you find some of my initial reviews, I would literally break down the option list of cars, which sometimes can be absolutely crazy with certain manufacturers, but I would break down the option list because, again, that was my philosophy of, you come to this review, you know everything. But then I realized that option lists change. The price of vehicles change, and how much are people going to come to this review and be like, oh, I want to scroll, or I want to look through it in that much detail. And I think the answer is, there's not that many people that will actually want to go in the finite details. There's certainly people out there, but not in every single nook and cranny. So shorting those reviews and therefore making it more condensed and appeal to a wider audience is what, in my opinion, big publishers are trying to do, because they want everyone to access their reviews. And even more importantly, people who are not interested in the product at all are still reading and watching their reviews because they're relatively condensed. So I guess that would be it. And in terms of time and money, they come hand in hand, because someone's time is charged to the company. So you have a certain day rate. You have that. So the more time you spend on reviewing a product, the lower that value of that written piece that you have is, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, it's just interesting because there was a post that blew up a couple of weeks back from an independent publisher that said, it's patently obvious that so many of these sites have never actually had hands on the product. And they do really detailed, in-depth product reviews. And they were saying the problem is that Google is rating like these quite well-established sites above ours, even though we're the ones that have done the deep dive, hands-on, like 4,000-word reviews. And Google just wants like to promote the little snapshotty ones. And I think, I don't know if that's sort of creating a bit of an audience trust problem, where if I want to spend 88K on an electric vehicle, I don't necessarily want like the top-line overview of it. Like, I want the detail.
Absolutely. I think that, I mean, that's part of it, but I do think that is also that question or that problem that publisher has is actually linked with how people are consuming media, right? So if you think of TikTok, for example, TikTok is one of the biggest social media platforms in the world. And if you are looking at the tech industry, specifically the B2C tech industry, most people don't have their attention span to watch through or read through an entire detailed review because they want to be spoon-fed that information. And I can't quite highlight or emphasize how many times I've come across comments on my YouTube channel in terms of the tech side of people asking me a question which has been covered in the video. And the worst thing about it is that my videos tend to be about 15 minutes long, right? It's not super, super long. They're time-stamped as well. You can go via the pinned comments or you can go via the chapter feature, which you can scroll through on mobile. And it's literally sometimes I like someone's asking me about, I don't know, how's the image quality? And I'm like, there is a section called image quality. That happens a lot in the tech industry. Whereas in the car industry, it's almost the opposite. It's because you've got an older audience, which are investing more money in their product. They will sometimes pick out not flaws, but certain things that I've mentioned in the video and be like, oh, this option that you've mentioned that's, I don't know, £1,495 is actually included in the £2,100 option, for example, because they're actually paying attention. And you can see that on the YouTube statistics, the retention average view duration. I can see the average view duration on the car side of stuff is a lot higher than it is on the tech side of stuff. Not because the tech videos are any less detailed, but because the market that I'm appealing to is teenagers to young to middle-aged adults. Whereas on the car side of stuff, it's middle-aged adults to older adults. There's a massive contrast between tech and cars. Mm. At least that's what I've found.
It's interesting that you say about those two different audiences, because I'd like to just dive into the revenue streams a bit. Do you monetize the two channels or the two brands differently, or have you found the same approach works for both those different audiences?
Yeah, it's a good question. So both of them are monetized the same way. So both of them make YouTube revenue. But on the car side of stuff, I've at least found it's a lot harder to get other revenue streams going. So I've got like an affiliate, so the equivalent of, let's say, Amazon, which would be on the tech side of stuff. But the money I make on affiliates on the car side of stuff is very, very slim, like very, very small. Sometimes it's, I do question myself if it's even worth adding a link. And the reason why is because if you think about it, someone is not going to come to a video, watch it, then click the link to get a leasing deal.
You've done a very good job if they click buy a car from that.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, they're more likely to watch the video, then go to the dealership and call the dealership and be like, I want a test drive. And then also say, okay, what are the deals you can offer over the phone? So that revenue stream has been a massive struggle for me on the car side of stuff. Whereas on the tech side of stuff, it has decreased over the years, like in comparison to the percentage that Amazon used to offer back in the days, in comparison to what they offer now. But that revenue stream is there because people are going to tech videos, watching them and clicking the link because they just want to be taken to the retailer, be it to check the price or just simply to buy it because they're like, oh, he or she has recommended that product or some competitor products. So I'm going to click it. So affiliate revenue is definitely there for the tech side of stuff, but it's not there, at least not in my case, on the car side of stuff. Now, again, both of them have YouTube revenue, but what's quite fascinating, and a lot of people don't know this, is that if you, for example, generated 100 views in cars and I generated 100 views in tech, your 100 views would be, let's say, paid, as a silly example, $100, and I would be paid $60, even though we generated the same amount of views on the same platform.
Oh, I thought YouTube had standardized CPMs.
Ah. No, so the CPMs differ. As far as I'm aware, they differ because... So, I mean, the views that I generate on Totally EV are much lower than on Totally Dubbed HD in terms of tech, but the tech sometimes is outperformed in terms of raw revenue from YouTube because of where the car channel is aimed at and the advertisers in cars. And on terms of, if you look online, if you go on X, for example, you'll probably be able to find some financial traders who do YouTube videos. And if you look at their revenue streams from YouTube, it's humongous. It's absolutely huge. in comparison to the amount of views they're generating. So it's very fascinating. It's something that I've found out maybe 3-4 years ago, same sort of time that I created Totally EV and went a bit more serious with YouTube, because I realized, oh, this is actually interesting. Now, if my car channel was 4 times larger, as in the same sort of size as my tech channel, I'm sure the amount of revenue I would be making on the car side of stuff might even outweigh all the revenue streams on the tech side of stuff. So yeah, so there's those revenue streams, and then you've also got direct sponsorships as well. So it's people who are paying for, be it inline adverts within a review or a video, or they're paying for a dedicated video. I tend to do a lot of dedicated videos with a bunch of different manufacturers, and that brings in a good revenue stream for me, again, on the tech side of stuff. But on the car side of stuff, at least again from my own experience, they're a lot more reluctant to do that because they have got bigger budgets and they've got entire film crews and photographers and all that stuff. They can create it themselves. Why do they need someone like Totally EV to come and create it for them? Unless I was an influencer and I could create some sort of buzz around a product and, I don't know, highlight some features that I love or whatever. But again, even by looking at some other influencers I follow and publications I follow, that's a bit few and far between, and or you have to have the right connections with that.
One of the things about running especially two brands like that is it sounds like a lot of your requests are inbound. Do you find you're having to do all the sales, PR, everything yourself for those brands?
Yes. people...
Wipe the sweat from your brow.
Yeah, exactly. I think people don't... So I can even say as for influencers, let alone for a small publication, people don't actually realize what it takes to be independent and what you have to do. Because when you're working, let's say, as a journalist, you're just working on the editorial side of stuff. More often than not, you have the contacts, or someone else within the team has a contact. And if you want to review a product, you can request one, or you'll get it pitched anyway because you're kind of known in the publishing world. As an independent, not only do I have to do a lot of requests myself, so yes, I do get inbound requests, but I do a lot of outreach. Majority, actually, I would say, is more outreach for me. So specifically on the car side of stuff, I will go and reach out to manufacturers and be like, have you got this product available? Or if it will be available at a later date, could you consider me? Or if you have an event coming up, I'd appreciate having an invite to it. And because I'm a small fish in like a big pot, I know that I'm not going to be their top priority. Some of the big guys are going to be, you know, the likes of Top Gear or whatever are going to be up there, not me. But sometimes it does mean that I am lobbed with those guys because they appreciate the content that I'm doing. So that happens every now and then, and it's always really nice and refreshing, be it in terms of being invited to really fancy places or going on international launches, for example. So yeah, in terms of doing it all yourself, yes, absolutely. You need to do it all yourself because not only do you have the editorial arm, but you've got the advertorial arm. You've then got, you know, as I said, like brands, you are creating your own brand. So your brand identity, you've not got a sort of strategy team. You're the one doing it. Back when we worked together, we had an entire e-commerce team. But you are it yourself. You are creating all the e-commerce links yourself. You're creating all the affiliate partnerships yourself. You're linking it within the website or the YouTube channel. And then you're also a social media manager, which people employ full time. And you are sharing on, let's say, TikTok, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, X, YouTube. You're doing all of that yourself. So yeah, as an independent, you actually have a lot of skills under you. And people don't actually realize not only the amount of time it takes, but also the amount of skills you need to learn.
The YouTube videos are often much, much longer. Do you recut that content for platforms like TikTok?
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly what I do. Sometimes I'll create unique shorts videos based on the product. But nowadays, because I do all my own B-roll, so again, like I'm a film crew on my own, right? I'm doing all my own B-roll. I sometimes have in mind, what do I want to film or what I want to highlight? And certain things are a bit more unique on a variety of different products. Sometimes, like on a car, I don't know, let's say the indicator sounds a bit different. So I would want to like highlight
that.
I know you'd That's the thing. There was a I reviewed the Jeep Avenger, and it had literally a full on beat. It was like a beat, like someone hitting a drum, which kind of drove me up the wall because I listened to music in the car, and it took away from the audio quality within the car. It clashed, but obviously it's a little fun thing. So that's a video I did, or I don't know, one of the most popular TikToks I did, which has I think 1.2 million plays right now, was on a tilting electric vehicle called the Carver Electric. So it's like a tilting bike. And I created that shorts video or TikTok video based on the regular B-roll that I shot at 16:9 for the main YouTube video. And a reason I do that, and the reason I also don't spend too much time on shorts, is because the money you make directly from shorts is next to nothing. As in, like, I could generate 50,000 views on whichever platform you want to choose, and I'll earn probably 0.02p's or something. I don't know, 0.2.
When you said you had one video with a million views, and it's like, yeah, but how much money has that made you?
that's made zero, because on TikTok, it's not on my TikTok, because I'm not large enough. I don't make any money from that. And it's funny, because I was talking to the person who lent me the car. He was at a garage, and he's the one who services the vehicles, and he's like the importer in the UK for it. He said there were people that reached out to him based on my video, which is really cool. And I love that. But again, I don't earn anything from that. And a YouTube video hasn't earned that much in the grand scheme of things in comparison to the amount of views it's generated or the amount of marketing it's provided to that company. And for me, more than anything, actually, the short form content is a great way of providing extra coverage to a manufacturer. And sometimes there's manufacturers that reach out to me, specifically on the tech side of stuff, that are only interested in short form content, and in terms of like a paid placement. And that's when I can offer those platforms again as an additional, hey, here's some short form content for you that you can actually use. Or let's say they want to send a product. I'm not interested in reviewing it, but I can create a short little reel TikTok/YouTube shorts about it. And the company is more than happy then to provide the product for me to showcase that versus me doing a full length video, which wouldn't truthfully be worth my time.
You've managed to get Total EV to, I think it was nearly 5,000, nearly 5 million views on YouTube now. What's next for you on the roadmap, if I'm allowed to use such a formal business term?
World domination, that's what I want. No, realistically, I set goals every year, beginning of the year, as like New Year's resolutions. And it's always up. So I'm always looking to expand. So for Total EV, realistically, what I'd love to do is have more unique videos out there, or more quicker access to newer vehicles. So therefore, just having a bit more of that closer relationship with the bigger guys in the car industry. So let's say Top Gear release a video, and the next video an hour later is Total EV's video. I'd love to be at that level, because these guys have got, not say infinite budgets, but they have much bigger publications, massive teams. Whereas as someone who's basically a one-man band, if I can compete with that, that would be really one of my goals. And it's kind of my ultimate goal, just constantly grow and build a community around Total EV that people are just coming back for those independent reviews. And the same applies for the tech side of stuff. Exactly the same.
Yeah, that can be sometimes weird. One of the tough things as a one-man band is that you do make progress. It's just much, much slower, and you kind of maybe don't necessarily have the team around you to bolster some of those wins. But 5 million is an amazing achievement.
It is, yeah. I mean, it's funny enough, when you saw that post on LinkedIn, it was at 4.9 million, just shy. And I think I'd hit 15,000 subscribers. And right now, I think I'm on 5.2 million already. So it's growing. Milestones, it's nice to see, you know, like 10 million views, 15 million views, 20 million, whatever it is. It's nice to see that. But the thing for me is not just the views and the subscribers, but it's more the engagement with the community and with the brands. That's the two things that I am actually more interested in. I rather have a lower viewership and a lower sub count, but much higher engagement and better relationship with brands than to say I've got 50 million views, but then no one's watching it. It brings a massive sense of joy when I see that growth is there, and it's all organic, and it's all completely natural, unpaid for. It's just there, and it's just people coming to watch it, and they're choosing to watch my videos that's awesome. That or obviously reading the articles on Total EV. That's what I love seeing. And if I can continue doing that and it keeps on growing and I still have brand relationships and all that stuff, then I'll never stop. That's like my dream as a kid, was to do what I'm currently doing and keep striving towards it. So
and as I mentioned at the top of the episode, we do a daily newsletter where we share the types of stories that we've been discussing today, every single day of the working week. Now, you might be thinking, well, Chris, that's just too much to get through. Well, you're totally wrong, because it's only the top four stories that you need to know. And every single newsletter is carefully curated by the three of us, myself, Esther, and Peter. Now, you can sign up to that by going to voices.media. All it takes is an email, and you can be assured that you'll be the smartest person in any given room in the media industry.
I'm talking about smart people in rooms.
Yes, yes, Esther. Good segue.
Yeah, I mentioned it a couple of times, but the Publisher Podcast and Newsletter Summits are on June the 12th. In the evening of June the 12th is the Publisher Podcast Awards. The shortlist for that is coming this week, April the 10th, if you are listening, this week. And you can find out all the shortlist, everything at publisherpodcasts.com.
But for now, thank you so much for listening. We are going to be back next week with another fantastic guest and a tour through everything to do with the media industry.
Hopefully Peter.
But for now, thank you so much for listening to the best goddamn media podcast on the block.
All right. I like that.